This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Very pleased you could spend some time here on the Country Hour this afternoon. A little later this hour, we'll take a look at the multi-billion dollar deal on critical minerals that's been struck between Australia and the United States and find out exactly what it means for Western Australia. And just before one, we will be heading to Mushave for the results of the sheep market. Terry Birkin, I think it is, going through the yarding and the prices for you just before the news at 1 o'clock today. 12:06 here on the Country Hour on the ABC right across Western Australia. First today, fishers, environmental groups, tourism operators and industry bodies spent yesterday workshopping ideas to form new guiding principles for fisheries management here in Western Australia. The meeting was called by the Fisheries Minister, Jackie Jarvis, after a damning assessment of WA's demersal fisheries found most were at high or severe sustainability risk. The Fishing Futures Forum was meant to lay all ideas on the table, but before walking into the forum, the minister told journalists outside that mandatory catch reporting for the recreational sector was off the table, and she reiterated that point again yesterday afternoon on Regional Drive with Andrew Collins.
So look, mandatory reporting across all fisheries was what we ruled out going into the election. And so we were very clear, we went to the election saying we're not having mandatory reporting. Look, if Recfish West and the recreational sector agree that we should have some catch reporting of select species that are under threat, then we can certainly look at that. But what we did rule out before the election was mandatory reporting of every catch. We just didn't think it was viable.
Okay, but what about for the ones that are under severe risk, say Jewfish, West Coast region? I mean, is mandatory reporting by Recfishers for those fish, is that on the table?
Look, I mean, Recfish West, who are the peak body, have said that they are.
You're the minister, though.
Absolutely. And look, all options are on the table. What I've said is we went to the election saying there'd be no mandatory reporting.
But that was of all species, isn't it? Is there a distinction here? You went to the election saying there won't be mandatory reporting of all species, but could there be mandatory reporting of some at severe risk species?
So, look, I'm not sure it's workable, and that's my concern, is that I don't think it's workable to actually have mandatory reporting of everyone going out in a tinny catching fish.
Why is it not workable?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that we can rely on that data, to be quite honest.
Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis. Melissa Haslam is the CEO of the WA Fishing Industry Council, which represents the commercial industry. She says the statements from the minister have left her shocked and at her wit's end.
I'm just absolutely gobsmacked. I mean, we went into this under the understanding all options are on the table. That was said multiple times. And to hear that, oh, except that the biggest thing you've been asking for, the elephant in the room, that's off the table, that's just crazy to us.
Did you know during those hours of discussion yesterday that the minister had already drawn a line through mandatory catch reporting with reporters outside?
No, I was not aware that that had been said. I mean, if I'm being honest, what the government said at the time of the election, we were aware that they didn't want to go down that route then. But now that we've seen the stock and how severe and how critical the situation is, and when we were told all options are back on the table, we thought all options were back on the table. And we were not aware that the minister had ruled it out again just before we all went into the forum yesterday.
Does she make a valid point, though? Because she doesn't think that it's workable, and she doesn't think that the data from Recfishers would be reliable. Is that not a fair point?
Well, it works in South Australia. And in Parliament yesterday, when we were at the Future Fishing Forum, we sat through a presentation on mandatory catch reporting in South Australia and how it works. So why on earth did they give us that presentation if all the time they had no intention of even considering it? We need to know what is coming out the water if we're going to manage these fish. We've been saying it all along. We need digital real-time reporting. We need it for everybody. Commercials as well. We do report everything within 100 grams of our catches, but we do it the old-fashioned way on paper. We say, give us digital real-time reporting. We'll use it tomorrow, but implement it for the wrecks as well. We have to. We don't know what's coming out of the water.
When you think about the negotiations between the commercial and the recreational sectors, you're saying, well, we need data. We need you to give us your data. What did the recreational sector want in exchange? What were the key negotiating points?
It didn't come down to that level. I mean, a lot of options were put on the table. I'd probably say there was a few key themes that came through. Certainly no decisions were made. For the commercial sector, there was talk around that real-time reporting for the commercial sector. There's clearly a desire to see the commercial sector move to quota-managed fisheries. Now, look, we'll cop that. If that's what's required to get this right, we'll cop that. But we also need the recs to report their data. And we're going to need to see something like tags introduced. We must reduce the rec effort. If there are any closures, the effort will just move to another region and another region will get decimated. Unless there are real measures in place to control the fishing effort, we are going to lose and lose and lose again.
So what do you do? Because you've got the fisheries minister saying that's off the table, not workable, not reliable. You're saying this data is absolutely essential. Those opinions are poles apart. So what do you do from here?
I don't know, Jo. I'm at my wit's end. I would think if I went to the average fisher out there and said, we need this data so that these species don't go extinct, are you happy to report your catch? My gut feel is the average person would go, it's not the end of the world. Now, I don't know what's going on, but for some reason, for whatever reason, people are saying, oh, it's too hard, it's too difficult. But like I say, we sat through a presentation yesterday for half an hour on mandatory catch reporting of the recreational sector in South Australia. What are we doing here?
Some of the other presentations looked at fisheries management around the world, and in some fisheries where the spawning biomass gets to 20%, it's a black and white decision. The fishery is closed. Do you feel that that's where this is heading? Because data's off the table. So how else do you carefully manage this fishery? Do you feel that that's where this is headed, is closure?
Well, and that would be devastating for everybody and unnecessary when we've proven we can turn fisheries around from a low base. We've done it elsewhere, like in the Gascoyne. So it's curious to me, even from the rec sector, why would you prefer a total closure over just reporting some data? I don't understand it, Joe.
And it does sound like cuts to catches are inevitable, whether that's managed through the current time management operations or whether the industry moves to quota. It sounds like the industry is going to lose some tons. How do you manage that and keep the commercial industry viable and keep fish supply coming into WA? What's that looking like for you now?
Oh, it's looking pretty shaky. I mean, like, this is not a hobby for us. This is how people pay their mortgages. It's how they put their kids through school. It's how every restaurant, every market, and every retailer gets their West Australian fish. It's through the commercial sector. If you keep cutting the commercial sector, there will be a point where they are unviable to operate, and we will all lose out then. No one will see West Australian fish anywhere. So we've got to get this balance right.
But do you support some level of cuts to catch if it is on the basis of sustainability, necessary for sustainability?
Look, sustainability has to come first. I couldn't argue that in any way, shape or form. Sustainability has to be first. So I would say put that first, make sure the fish stocks are sustainable, and whatever's necessary to get us back to a sustainable level, that's what we have to consider. I'm just saying there's many ways to skin a cat. And there's many ways to achieve that. It could be all manner of things. And in some instances, if it had to be cuts, it would have to be cut. Certainly, we have to reduce effort in some areas. And I acknowledge that.
And we did hear the minister indicate that if Recfish West supported mandatory catch reporting that it would be looked at. Do you try and lobby Recfish West?
What an insane position that is. No, who's running this show? We need to lobby the minister. The minister needs to make a decision on this, and it shouldn't be up to what Recfish West would like.
That is the CEO of the WA Fishing Industry Council, Melissa Haslam. And she was speaking to Joe Prendergast, 12:15 here on the Country Hour. Andrew Rowland is the CEO of Recfish West. Andrew, when WOFIC went into the fishing forum yesterday, it thought that all options were on the table. They did not know the fisheries minister had already ruled out mandatory catch reporting. What did you know of the minister's position? Did you have an assurance from her that she did not support mandatory reporting?
We had assurance from the Premier going into the election, Belinda. this was something that came up when we were looking at the West Coast a few years ago. And Recfish West, we went away and looked at all the options around the place. And we did have a really good look at mandatory reporting, but our global search around the world really did show that it wasn't workable. It was unreliable. It was very expensive. The South Australian example just recently, they introduced it on pink snapper and they've shown that it doesn't work. It's unreliable. It's open to manipulation. For example, so that was our position. We put it to the government. We have seen no evidence from the proponents for mandatory reporting that the current system is inadequate. In fact, you know, West Australia leads the country in terms of its recreational catch and effort data recording. And so there's no actual burning need to work out how many more fish, we shouldn't be looking at how we count the fish better. We should be looking at how we manage them better. And I think
But things are different now. We've got new information from DPIRD after the election. So you had that assurance in the lead up to the state election, but we've got different and new information on the table now. Did you have an assurance from the minister prior to this forum yesterday that mandatory reporting was off the table?
Well, it was a policy position of the government. The Premier and the Deputy Premier and the Minister had already ruled it out in government policy ahead of the 2025 election. So I don't think it was on the table. We did the work to look at it and understand it, and we saw all of these problems with it, and we saw no evidence coming forward that the current reporting of recreational catches in terms of the work the department does is inadequate. And there was there's no proposal here from the commercial fishing sector on how it would work. And so I think the burden of proof must go on those that are proposing these things to, one, show that the current system's inadequate, and two, put a system on the table that they think will work, because we've looked globally and it simply doesn't work.
Melissa Haslam was just asking who's running the show. Is it you, Andrew?
Absolutely not, Belinda. Our role is to work with the government around ideas that come up. Mandatory reporting was a bad idea. We don't want mum and dad in the tinny washing down their boat at the end of a day's fishing, getting knocked off by a fisheries officer because they haven't done the paperwork.
Wouldn't they rather that than have the fisheries closed altogether? Surely that's not too much of a burden.
Well, there's plenty of other options here, Belinda, and this is what we would need to be discussing. Why aren't we talking about protecting of the breeding stock? We must be looking at improving breeding protection for our fisheries.
But don't we have to look at all options, you know, all options on the table, considering how serious the sustainability threat to demersal fish in WA now is? Isn't it time to reconsider things like mandatory real-time catch reporting?
This has already been looked at and it's already been discounted. I think that's the thing. Why would we go back over old ground when we need to be looking forward to the future?
Because how serious the situation is.
Yeah, well, we can look at that, but we're wasting time. We need to look at actually things that work and actually manage the fish stock, not necessarily counting the fish that come out of the water.
Why do you think there was a presentation yesterday from South Australia looking at how mandatory reporting works in the recreational sector for snapper catches? Why was that sort of looked at, entertained yesterday?
There was a snapper presentation on the snapper in South Australia. I must have missed the bit around mandatory reporting. But when we went and looked at South Australia, it was open to manipulation. So in South Australia, where they had it, Belinda, the two biggest reporters of snapper catch was the conservation sector and a commercial fisher. There was no validation of the information. So to have this system work properly, everybody has to have a unique identifying feature. So we have to go through the Service WA app, which is completely overreach and Big Brother and is unnecessary. And we also need to tell the government when we don't catch fish, and that's what happens in Tasmania. You can be fined if you go rock lobster fishing and you don't catch anything, and if you don't record, if you don't put a zero down on your paperwork, you're open to a $550 fine. We do not need it here, and it doesn't work, and that's the point. Like, we've been through this, and I don't understand why we're talking about counting the fish. The current estimates are pretty good. We need to be talking about real measures to protect the biomass and to protect the breeding stock, yet we keep going back over old ground.
What we just heard from Melissa Haslam from WAFIC, though, was that if we don't know what's coming out of the water, how do we manage it? How do we manage sustainability going future?
Well, we do know what's coming out of the water. The work that the department does is peer-reviewed. WAFIC and the commercial sector have never brought forward any evidence to show that that's inadequate. So I don't accept the narrative that we don't know what's coming out of the water. We've known that for quite some time. It can be more timely. There is a bit of a lag between the way that the boat ramp estimates and the phone diary surveys are done. And you know, with any scientific data, it can always be delivered quicker. But it is robust, it is peer-reviewed, and it stacks up globally against the world's best standards. So there isn't even an argument here. It's a nonsense thing.
The commercial sector say without this real-time data, there's no way to properly manage fisheries and guide their recovery. What do you think is the best way to fix this sustainability crisis scientists now say that the demersal fisheries are in?
Well, we think we need targeted protection of the spawning stock. We've seen the benefits in Coburn Sound. We've seen the benefits in Shark Bay. We've seen the benefits in the Gascoyne. Why aren't we protecting the breeding stock? We currently need to focus around the state on actually protecting the fish when they're breeding and where they're breeding as best as we can. It is a proven fundamental tenement of fisheries management. We don't have any breeding protection, total breeding protection for jewfish, for example. The recreational fishing sector, we put our closure during the peak spawning time for jewfish, but the other sectors can still fish during that period. We know that there's places where jewfish get together during the late summer and autumn months to spawn. Why aren't we stopping the fishing happening at those times and places? These are funded. We've used this in other places around the state, and we need to focus on that. We have no spawning protection for pink snapper in Midwest. We've got 1,000 kilometres of coastline between the breeding aggregations in Coburn Sound and the ones up in Shark Bay. The recovery of the Shark Bay pink snapper fishery is an amazing success story, and it was all based on protecting the breeding fish when they were breeding.
Just one other point from the forum yesterday. Nathan Harris, who's an executive director at Deep Herd, he presented at the fishing forum yesterday, and he said that the spawning biomass of jewfish in the West Coast demersal zone is at 15%, but in the recreational-only area from Mandra to Lancelin, this number is as low as 7%. Do those figures ring alarm bells for you?
Absolutely they do, but we've taken action, Linda. So the recreational sector over the last 2 years have dropped out catch by 30%. So we're leaving 75 tonnes more fish in the water each year. And so the jewfish stock in Western Australia runs from Kalbarri effectively through to about Albany. There's a lot of coastline there. It's one stock. And we've already taken measures that haven't yet showed up in the stock assessment because these fish don't enter the fishery until they're 5 to 6 years old, but we've dropped the recreational catch by 30% in the last 2 years. So we've done some things through the measures, through closures and through bag limits and other things. We're on our way. The jewfish stock is not declining, and I think that's another part of the narrative here. Neither is the pink snapper stock on the West Coast. We've arrested those declines and they're rebuilding. The real question is that they're not rebuilding as fast as we all want. But we've started the process. 30% reduction in rec catch, 5.5 months worth of closure, reductions in bag limits, a whole range of measures. And those measures are yet to show through in the stock assessment because those fish haven't yet entered the fishery that we've protected over the last couple of years.
Well, WAFIC at this point is not happy. It really did want mandatory reporting for the rec sector to be on the table. Where to from here at this point as far as addressing the issue?
Well, I think it's really important, Belinda. This is a publicly owned resource right across the whole of Western Australia. We're talking about all of our demersal fisheries. And it's really important that the government of the day and the minister and the executive government, they need to ensure that the sustainable use translates to public benefit. So they must set the direction for our fisheries. There's an immense amount of value that we get as Western Australians from our fishing activities for this group of fish, whether it be for red emperor, pink snapper, jewfish or nanogai. And it's really important that the management is directed and guided to maximise and optimise the benefits that our fishing activity, whether it be recreational or commercial or seafood supply, tourism, what those benefits must deliver back to the community. And so that high-level policy direction is missing, and we need the government to say, what do you want from our fishing activities? When there's less fish to go around, Belinda, it's more important than ever that we actually maximise and extract the most value out of every single fish that we catch. And we believe that, particularly on the west coast or the southern half of Western Australia, that it should be prioritised for recreational fishing and tourism. In the north, we've got amazingly productive tropical fisheries. That's where majority of our seafood supply comes from. It's also very important for livability in places like Karratha and Port Hedland. Fishing is part of our lifestyle and culture. But the fisheries up there in terms of productivity are 10 times more productive. So 4,000 tonnes of fish come out of our Pilbara and Kimberley fisheries, and we're talking about 400 tonnes south of Kalbarri all the way through down to Esperance.
Andrew, thanks for being part of the conversation this afternoon.
Thanks, Belinda.
Andrew Rowland is the CEO of Rec Fish West. 26 past 12 here on the Country Hour, and we will get an update from the newsroom for you very shortly.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Just before those news headlines, the new president of the National Farmers Federation says his top priorities are tackling the high cost of production and increasing local manufacturing and value-adding opportunities for the farm sector. Queensland farmer Hamish McIntyre was elected to the top job on Friday, taking over the role from David Johinke, who'd reached the limit of his board term with the organisation. Hamish McIntyre says he'd like to see the government's enthusiasm for agriculture as high as it is for renewable energy.
My background is obviously mixed farming. We produce broad commodities, including, you know, beef, grain, cotton especially, and also, you know, in the lamb game, and have a broiler chicken operation too. So we're across many sectors, and our business is about, you know, evaluating the commodities we produce into higher value where we are, so using our own grain and cottonseed and hay, et cetera, to finish our own cattle. So I see across a lot of areas where things are going very well, and the markets and our trade, and it's a great outlook there, and the world wants the commodities we produce. But also what I feel as a producer, and obviously paying the bills, I mean, it's the cost of production is really rising, and it, with some of the commodities we're producing, it, you know, it is getting very tight, you know, when you do a gross margin. So I'd really like to focus on, with government, we had a particular situation in our own business this year where we actually couldn't get urea to apply in crop to our winter wheat crops when we wanted it, even though we'd done the forecasts and things, and it was due to shipping constraints for whatever reason. But that's the first time that, due to us not manufacturing urea, you know, close to us, our situation, Brisbane, that we were, our crops were actually affected by a shipping constraint. So that's a real eye-opener to me and a warning. And when that flows on too, that you think about our situation with diesel and ag tech too, particularly the, you know, that we're not producing our own glyphosate tech, those sort of essential products in Australia anymore. I think we are putting ourselves into a corner, having to rely on overseas shipping channels to sustain ourselves, which, you know, does roll onto a food security issue, doesn't it, for our population, and also a security issue. So I'd really like to work with government and the other industries that it's critical to, you know, transport and so on, that really, you know, highlight to our governments how important it is to get that manufacturing value adding going back in Australia so we can sustain ourselves and, you know, just make sure we are secure for the long term, because, you know, obviously constructing those sort of plants to produce fertilizer and ag tech don't happen overnight. So it's a long-term plan, but we need to all work hard to convince government to back those things as much as they back renewable. You know, we support all energy sources, and but just not renewable at any cost. And it's does reflect with what's happening with fertilisers, but it is very important for us to have our own available.
You do have quite broad operations and you've also served as chair of Cotton Australia previously. How will your experience benefit you in this role, especially when it comes to advocacy work?
Yes, look, I've had experience with Cotton Australia as chair for 3 years. You know, obviously we were navigating some fairly tricky issues at that stage when I was chair around water policy and, you know, the Murray-Darling plan and our water resources plans in our own areas and right across the cotton growing region. So that was great experience, you know, working with government and highlighting where the issues are and what things like buyback do to our regional communities. I mean, we're always so strong on, you know, works and measures, you know, efficiencies measures, and highlighting that because it's our regional communities suffer when, you know, productive water is taken out of the system. So understand all those issues and the effects, and, you know, it flows onto our workforce and in regional Australia, everywhere, if we have less people around, it's just very hard to get done what we need to do. So we need families incentivised to come back to rural Australia. And it's another big thing that we've got to work out a way with government to attract families. I mean, we hear about housing crises continually, don't we, in the eastern seaboard and around our cities of Australia. But, you know, let's build homes too in regional Australia and attract people to it if we have to work with government. I mean, people have talked about it forever, but let's get on with it. You know, if we have to incentivize them with taxation advantages or whatever to come and live and work in regional Australia, let's do it. So NFF has great policies around all those areas, and I'll be working within that policy framework that comes from members, but those things are very important to us.
Incoming President of the National Farmers Federation, Hamish McIntyre, and he was speaking to Taylor Larson. 29 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Jonathan Hopper is in the studio. He's got the news headlines for you. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The WA Premier, Roger Cook, says the Prime Minister showed great leadership during his meeting with the US President after the pair struck a critical minerals deal and recommitted to the AUKUS agreement. Anthony Albanese and Donald Trump announced the multi-billion dollar critical minerals partnership, with the first project being the development of a gallium refinery near Wagerup, south of Perth. A man from Perth South will face court next month following his arrest on a number of charges, including building a homemade firearm. The Greenfields man is also accused of being in possession of a gun stolen from a property in the Wheatbelt in 2015, as well as owning pepper spray and an electric shock device. The 38-year-old is due to face the Mandurah Magistrates Court next month. And the AFL has appointed Sydney's Dean Cox and Geelong's Chris Scott as coaches for WA and Victoria for the State of Origin AFL clash in Perth in February. WA and Victoria haven't played each other since 1992, and players will be selected based on the junior club from where they were drafted. Thanks, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you for the update. 28 to 1, still to come here on the Country Hour. We'll head to Mouchet for the results of the sheep market and also see what's in it for Western Australia, this multi-billion dollar deal on critical minerals between Australia and the United States. We'll get into that shortly here on the Country Hour. First, though, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Joey Rawson is with you this afternoon. Joey, what's the story across the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, hi, Belinda. We've got a couple of things going on through the southwestern parts of the state. We've had that low that crossed the southwest yesterday that brought some showers, some quite good falls out of that, especially through the Perth and Perth Hills areas, getting around that 10 to 20 millimetre mark. But that low now is south of Esperance, and it's moving into the Great Australian Bight. So at the moment, we've just got showers along the south coast, and those showers will ease as that low progresses into the Great Australian Bight. But still, some good showers around the sort of Esperance coast, and even a couple of thunderstorms in the southern goldfields, and even pushing into the Eucla. As we progress on to tomorrow, we start seeing a high pressure system move over, and conditions certainly contract, or showers contract to the south coast. But it will be cold tomorrow around the great southern part. So temperatures getting near that 0 degree mark, Belinda, for tomorrow morning around places like Lake Grace and Hyden and Katanning. So it could be a slight chance of frost. You know, the temperatures maybe 2-3 degrees. So certainly cool tomorrow morning. But as we move on to Thursday, we have a trough that develops inland from the west coast. And on the eastern side of that trough, there's some potential for some thunderstorms through the southern parts of the Kalgoorlie, of the Goldfields and the southeast coastal district. As far as rainfall amounts, it could be around 10 to 20 millimetres if a thunderstorm does come over the top. And things get a little bit even more interesting on Friday as we have a similar system that we had over the last 24 hours with a low pressure system moving over the Southwest Land Division and doing something very similar, moving to kind of over the ocean, over the Esperance Coast, and dropping probably around 10 to 20 millimetres through kind of southern and western parts of the Southwest Land Division on Friday before those showers contract to the south coast on Saturday. So a little bit of winter still left in the system, Belinda.
Yeah, we just can't shake it, can we? Let's have a look across northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, so there's stuff going on there as well. But in short, there's the potential for thunderstorms through the Kimberley interior and also southeastern parts of the Pilbara for the next kind of 4 or 5 days. But as far as rainfall out of those storms, it won't be much more than 10 millimetres if you do get a storm. And as we progress on to later parts of the week, it's certainly going to be quite hot through the Kununurra, Wyndham, Argyle areas. And we do have heat wave type conditions starting to evolve through that area. But, potential for thunderstorms just persisting for a number of days, Belinda.
Thank you so much, Joey. 24 to 1. Let's check the rainfall figures. A look back at the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning and checking 5 mils and over. In northern and eastern forecast districts, in the Kimberley, Billaluna 5, Country Downs 11, Derby Main Roads 5. And then into the Southwest Land Division, in the Central West, Irwin House had 6, Jurien Bay had between 5 and 11, Lanceland Defence 6. The Lower West, Anketell 17, Bickley 22, Bindoon 6, Bolgart Bin 9, Bungendore 18, Dwelling Up 10, Gingin West 17, Gleneagles 16, Jandakot Aero 26. Jarrodale had between 24 and 27, Julimar Forest 12, Carrigullen North 21, Lake Chittering 5, Lancelin East 8, Mandurah 6, Millenden 22, Minston Park 6, Mount Solis 20, Mushay 20, Mundaring 16, Nunal 14. Pierce RAF Base 17, Perth Metro 17, Pinjarra between 8 and 10, Serpentine 23, Tamala Park 15, 2J East 15, Wanneroo had between 14 and 27, Wattening 8, Werribee 24 and Whiteman Park 30. Into the southwest, Beedalup 18, Boyanup North 8, Busselton Aero 7, Carlotta 26, Donnybrook between 3 and 7, Ferguson Valley had between 5 and 6, Four Acres 5, Manjimup 5, Nanup 21, Newlands 6, Northcliffe 21, Quinnanup 11, Scott River 6, Shannon 17, Walpole Forestry 22, Warner Glen 11, Windy Harbour 8, Yanmar 6 and Yungurulup 6. Southern coastal region, Bremer Bay 8, Dalyup Park 7, Denbarker between 4 and 8, Esperance 8, Gardner 8, Hopetoun North had 6, Inglebourne 5, Jerramungup 7, Kimberley 25, King River 9, Mount Barker 5, Munglenup between 1 and 6 in the gauge, Stirling South 6, Tamar 6, Warrajarra 5 and Wellstead 5. In the central wheat belt, Ardeth 8, Babbican 9, Balka East 6, Beverley 8, Bungulla 15, Kalgi 10, Kodjkodjan 6, Kalkowring 5, Cunderdon Airfield 11, Doodlakine 10, Dungan Peak 11, East Beverley 9, Gumelling 7, Grabble 6, Hines Hill 7, Calibaran Aero 16, Meriden between 3 and 6, Mount Hardy 12, Mount Noddy 9, Mount Westdale 11, Muresk 22, Nanginan 7, Northam 18 to 20, Quadney 14, Queriting had 6, Shackleton 10, Tamman had between 13 and 14, Wheal 7, Yangadine 8 and York had between 9 and 10. And we'll finish up in the Great Southern, Bulyi 5, Coondee 5, Corrigan had 5 but that was over 4 days, Culford 10, Franklin 5, Glenrose 6, Kundinan Aero 5, Quida 5, Lake King 9, Magenta Dam 7, Mount Madden East had 9, Narrogin 5, Pingaring 7, Pingerley West 7, and Williams North had 6.
You're with Belinda Varischetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
21 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Well, overnight, a multi-billion dollar deal on critical minerals was struck between Australia and the United States. US President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese signed a $13.5 billion agreement on rare earths and critical minerals. Now, these minerals are crucial for new technologies like mobile phones and renewable energy infrastructure, but they're also a key sticking point in the US-China trade war. The deal creates a pipeline of projects to not only mine, but process critical minerals and rare earths and challenge China's stronghold in this market. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese explained some of the details of the deal as he sat in the White House cabinet room.
Part of this deal is very specific, $8.5 billion pipeline. There'll be $1 billion contributed from Australia and the United States over the next 6 months with projects that are immediately available. There's three groups of projects, ones that are joint activities between Australia and the United States, such as Alcoa. Secondly is projects that will be US investment that the US will undertake in Australia, including processing, and then ones that Australia will undertake, some as well. One of them is Australia, the US and Japan as well. So what we're trying to do here is to take the opportunities which are there. Australia has had a view for some time, a bit similar to putting America first.
Right.
Our plan's called A Future Made in Australia, which is about not just digging things up and exporting them, but how do we make sure that we have across the supply chains with our friends being able to benefit, seize those opportunities. So we certainly see part of what this is about isn't just digging things up. It's also about processing, including the joint ventures between Australia and the United States.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. Professor Susan Park is a specialist in critical minerals and global governance at the University of Sydney. She says the new deal is an opportunity for Australia, particularly when it comes to processing these minerals.
So this is a really important deal for Australia because we have approximately 31 critical minerals of high geological content, which means we can extract them for profit. And the Australian government has identified that 80% of critical minerals are unexplored in Australia. So there's a really big opportunity here. The history of Australian mining, particularly for critical minerals, is that we dig and ship, that we actually don't process them. And lithium, for example, 98% goes to China for processing. So this is where the vulnerability comes in when you've got one country that does all the processing. So there's a number of critical minerals where China has dominance. Rare earth elements is one of them. 70% of rare earth elements are produced by China, and 90% of that is processed by China. So there's an absolute vulnerability in the global supply chain if anything happens, which we're starting to see now. So the benefit for Australia is that we have this opportunity to go, hopefully, not just to sell our critical minerals, but to actually go further up the processing chain to actually get involved in refining and processing.
So that makes us a reliable partner. It gives us reliability at home too, as you say, if something happens in the world and there's a shortage. But we needed American investment, did we, to kickstart this, to get it going?
Yes, in some ways, absolutely. Because for many of these critical minerals, they are a relatively new market, highly volatile market. We find a boom and bust cycle in mining, particularly, for example, lithium, where we know we need lithium for electric vehicles, for solar panels, for a whole range of technologies. But then the market gets over-exuberant and then assumes that they'll be hitting the market. And then there's a bust because all of a sudden that exuberance dissipates, even though the demand is still there. And so what we find is that investment is necessary, and mining is a long-term game. It takes, you know, up to 8 years to get a mine up and running. So this is why we need long-term, reliable investment coming from partners that are willing to do that.
And is this a good deal for us?
I think in some ways it is. I mean, we're going to see more of it coming out over the coming days. The Prime Minister mentioned joint activities, which is absolutely what Australia wants. So we want not just to be able to hand over the minerals, but we want some say in the processing and the refining. They also mentioned that the US will invest in Australia for processing. So that's a benefit. We mm-hmm. didn't actually see that, you know, was likely because mm-hmm. of the whole MAGA focus on domestic manufacturing and jobs.
America first, yeah.
America first, that's absolutely right. So there is some benefits here, and we are seeing the equity investment in companies in Australia, but also the potential to have more processing. I'd like to see more on refining as well, you know, further stages down the processing track, but this is a good start.
You mentioned there that we already dig up quite a bit, but we give it to China. This pivot away, perhaps, from dealing with China when it comes to critical minerals and helping the US secure theirs, do you think China will be upset and could punish us for doing that?
Well, they've done so in the past. Mm. The trade restrictions on Australian exports in relation to Australia seeking a COVID inquiry with the WHO. So that was pretty clear that China was displeased with how Australia was behaving. So there is that possibility. I think Richard Miles quite clearly said trade is good for Australia. So trying to make it clear that this is not specifically against China, although that is how the United States is framing it. Mm. So Australia is going to have to do quite a lot of backpedaling to reassure China. But it really comes down to the offtake agreements of, you know, lithium, for example, 98% goes to China. They have offtake agreements and they have strong and reliable partnerships to be able to do that. Whether or not this is taking advantage of new mineral opportunities rather than shifting away from existing opportunities is important. But I think what's really, really clear is that Australia has already indicated that they're not willing to take more investment from China in Australia in critical minerals.
Could we become, with this deal, a real global player on the critical mineral stage?
It's a good question. Both the United States and the European Union are looking for a stable supply partner mm-hmm. of critical minerals. The European Union is even in more trouble than the United States in terms of reliance on China for its critical minerals, but also for its solar panels and technologies. Mm. But we are in competition. We're in competition with the lithium iron triangle in Latin America, South Africa, Brazil. You know, there are critical minerals all around the world. So it kind of really is a race to see who can get to market and who can actually maintain those strong partnerships.
And I guess do it efficiently as well. And finally, we often talk about this transition we're going through here in Australia, and a lot of people are worried about people who have jobs at the moment in the mining industry. What's the future hold for them? Could this be the start of an industry that could replace some of those mining jobs and secure some of those futures?
Yeah, I don't actually see them as being related, to mm-hmm. be honest. Australia is the world's largest exporter of black coal. Mm-hmm. So this is high-grade coal. You know, we talk about the transition, but colleagues routinely admonish me. This is really an addition. What we're seeing now is we are not declining in the amount of fossil fuels that we are using. And these are completely separate markets for completely separate things. So we can talk about renewable energy and solar panels, but they're not in any way challenging our other exports.
Critical Minerals and Global Governance Specialist Susan Park. She was speaking to Sarah Morris on ABC News Radio after a multi-billion dollar critical minerals deal was signed overnight between the US and Australia. 12 minutes to one. Warren Pearce is the CEO of the Association of Mining and Exploration Companies. He thinks WA has a lot to gain from this deal.
Rare earths themselves aren't that rare, but what is rare is finding the right elements together in the same place in a commercially viable deposit. And Western Australia is very well endowed in that regard. We've had the Northern Minerals Project and Browns Range operating for a long time now, last 5-6 years. You've got Iluka, the mineral sands company, now developing a rare earths processing facility, and indeed the world's only rare earths processing facility outside China in Kalgoorlie, Lynas Rare Earths. So we're in a great place to really benefit from this and really grow our rare earths processing industry here in WA.
So what do we get out of it? Is this about processing rather than just digging up and shipping out?
Yeah, it's about both. So importantly, it's about getting the investment to actually build the mines and the processing facilities.
And that investment will come from the US.
Some of it will. Probably most of it is the reality, but also the Australian government's committing to put more investment in it itself. That's part of the partnership between the US and Australia. Why this matters is because China's got a dominance and a stranglehold on the rare earths industry and the processing industry. Almost all the world's rare earths processing is done in China, which means any nation that relies on rare earths for their advanced manufacturing and all those products I mentioned before is vulnerable if China decides to cut off the export of those goods. And with more and more export controls being put around, that's looking more and more likely, which means we've got to find a way of developing a supply chain outside of China. For Australia to do that, we need to be able to finance and build our projects, and we need a customer. And right now, our only customer really for rare earths is China, because they're the only ones who do the processing. With a partner like the United States stepping up with such a big market and such a strong technology capacity, we've got the perfect partner to help us get our industry up and have a buyer for our goods.
So now we potentially now have an export market.
That's right. And indeed, with the United States president making it so clear it's a big part of his plan, I think that'll be an important signal to the rest of the world. And you'll start to see those developed nations in the EU start to look to Australia as well.
Would we be competitive when it comes to pricing with China?
Well, we're not. And that's the whole point. The reason we're not competitive is because China's managed to take control of the entire supply chain, which means they can drive the price down on the rare earth concentrate and process, and they pass the price on at a higher level in the supply chain, which means we're not competitive on a straight competitive basis. That's exactly why we need market interventions from governments and places like the United States government to try and right this problem, get a broader industry taking place outside of China, create a market, and where things can go back to something where we can compete on a level playing field. So right now, there's not a level playing field, and that's why we need to find these ways of getting these projects up.
So Lynas is the only company that's processing rare earths at the moment in WA, is that right?
Yeah, in Australia.
And then you've got Iluka. They are building a rare earths processing plant in Eneabba. What will that
that's
process?
Right. Rare earths.
Okay.
So, and this is the thing. The rare earths, because there's 13 different elements, there's a range of different types of rare earths.
Heavy, so they'll be doing a few things.
That's right. And indeed, there are other projects here in Western Australia. Hastings Rare Earths are looking to build a processing facility themselves backed by Wyloo. And indeed, you'll have others who begin to look at that space. And indeed, there are projects in the Northern Territory and New South Wales as well. So Western Australia is not the only one who will get some benefit out of this. There's a wide opportunity across the nation.
And Alcoa, are they also going to go into this space?
That's right. So they're not in the rare earth space. They're on a critical mineral called gallium. Gallium goes into LED lights, solar panels and solar cells, as well as semiconductors. So really important. Gallium's a byproduct, or can be a byproduct, of bauxite refining, which is indeed what Alcoa does down at Wagerup. And so supported by the United States government with a commitment today, they're going to build a gallium processing plant to actually add that byproduct to their product list, and they'll produce that and provide that through the United States. So the critical minerals agreement could cover a lot of things. Right now, we're sort of focused on rare earths, but it could tend to be a wide range of minerals that actually this partnership begins to apply to, which would mean more companies and more regions get the benefit.
Association of Mining and Exploration Companies CEO Warren Pearce speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos. 8-1 on the text, Philip says, US critical minerals deal, when you sup with the devil, be sure to use a long spoon. Thank you, Philip. Well, as you can imagine, a number of WA-based companies stand to benefit from the new critical minerals deal with the US. One of them is Northern Minerals, which has a rare earths project in the East Kimberley. That mine is not operating at the moment, but the company is working towards that. Chair Adam Hanley says the agreement will be a significant step forward for the industry as a whole.
I think it signals the resolve of the US and Australia, along with other Western nations, to develop independent supply chains for critical minerals and heavy rare earths. So important for the country, important for the state, and important for companies like Northern Minerals who are looking to play their part in developing those independent supply chains.
So you've made an announcement this morning off the back of this deal. What have you announced this morning, and what does it involve?
Yeah, so there are seven companies who received letters of intent for funding from the combination of the US or Australian governments pursuant to the agreement announced by President Trump and Prime Minister Albanese today. So we've announced that we have a a non-binding letter of intent from US Exim, the financing arm of the US government, and EFA, the financing arm of the Australian government, to try to develop our Browns Range heavy rare earth project in WA.
What is Browns Range? Can you just explain it again? Not everyone's an expert in this area. What is it?
Just let me say, we're ASX listed and we 100% own Browns Range. Browns Range is a very, very important and very good quality dysprosium and terbium resource. Now, what is Dy and Tb? They're two of the what we call heavy rare earths. Yep. That are required to function in today's modern world. So basically they make magnets strong, and magnets are used in things like EVs, wind turbines and military systems and fighter jets to make them function properly.
Is your mine operating at the moment?
No. So we have just released a definitive feasibility study or a detailed study to get the mine funded and up and running. We did produce from a pilot plant a couple of years ago. We proved we could do it, but we're looking to do it full scale to meet around about 8% or 9% of the world's demand for these resources. And so we're looking to raise about $600 million plus to develop the mine in the next couple of years.
Okay. And so would you be processing here as well?
Yes. You made the point that this deal is not just about mining. It's also about processing. We will semi-process. So we'll produce a dysprosium and terbium concentrate called a xenotime concentrate. So it's a semi-processed product. And we will then ship that down to the Iluka refinery that you mentioned and Warren mentioned is being built at Eneabba. So we'll truck it down to Iluka. Iluka will then do the extra processing to produce an oxide to sell to the market.
And your obvious market would be the US. Beyond that, have you identified other potential export markets?
Yes, very strong demand for dysprosium and terbium and heavy rare earths generally. So US is an obvious market, but also very strong demand from Asia and Europe as well. So we've been, as we've announced before, fielding a number of inquiries from other markets as well.
And has your share price gone up?
You'll forgive me for admitting I have had a little peak. I think when I last looked, we were up about 10%.
Yep, we've been peeking at some of these companies as well, and it's going gangbusters for some of you this morning, I must say.
Look, I think really the important point here is this is giving the Western world who are looking to stand up these independent supply chains confidence that the backing is there to do it. So I think it's a really significant boost for the whole industry, not just Northern Minerals.
Northern Minerals Chair Adam Hanley speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos. As you just heard, Northern Minerals share price is up about 12% today after receiving letters of support from key Australian and US government agencies for its Brown Range rare earth project in the East Kimberley. 4 minutes to one to the market, and about 11,600 sheep and lambs sold at the Mouchet sale yards this morning. Terry Birkin's been keeping an eye on the sale for you. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Belinda. The yarding total was down from last week by around 5,500, with both lamb and mutton supplies easing. New season lambs carrying weight declined notably today, with limited heavy lambs available. With the return of a major feedlot buyer bidding on selected weights, most lamb categories held firm in pricing, with the exception of heavy lambs easing $8 to $10 a head. Boning mutton were in demand and gained $8 to $10, while heavy mutton eased slightly by $4 to $5 a head. New season store lambs held firm, ranging from $90 to $176, as did air freight weights, selling from $160 to $200 a head. Trade lambs were equal and returned $188 to $222, while heavy lambs eased $8 to $10 to sell from $220 to $237 a head. Old season store lambs ranged from $90 to $159, while light lambs were selling from $152 to $178 a head. Old season trade lambs returned $173 to $199, while heavy lambs sold to a top of $257 a head. The limited volume of merino weather hoggets were making $160 to $220, while merino ewe hoggets sold from $158 to $180 a head. Crossbred hoggets returned $158 to $220, and younger rams sold to a top of $210. Boner mutton gained $10, selling from $110 to $198. While medium ewes and heavy ewes eased $4 to $5 and sold from $160 to $232, regardless of weight. Heavy weathers were firm, selling from $162 to $223, while mature rams sold from $56 to $220 a head. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you for that. It's about a minute and a half away from the news at 1 o'clock. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about the result of the Fisheries Forum that was held yesterday. And everyone in the room, the key players, talking about what needs to be done, especially for WA's demersal fisheries, which, well, most of them were at high or severe sustainability risk. And the commercial sector, WAFIC, not happy that mandatory reporting for the recreational sector was off the table even before the meeting started. Anthony Haygarth on the text says, so all options are on the table, but not if Recfish West doesn't want them on the table. How on earth did we get to this point where Recfish West is running the fisheries portfolio? It's funny how mandatory reporting has worked for the commercial sector for decades, but it can't possibly work for Recfishers. The demersal fishery is only in crisis because the government caved in to Recfish West. Let's not forget that almost all jewfish and bullchin groper are caught by the rec sector. Andrew Rowland's only answer is to continually relocate the total allowable catch, the tack, from the commercial sector to the rec sector. Eventually, there'll be no commercial tack left to reallocate. What then, Andrew? Asked Anthony. And then this too. Belinda, just asking how proponents of mandatory reporting of recreational catches propose they will police it. It's just that it has to be every fish caught that is recorded, or it may as well be none. Thank you for that, Jason. Appreciate your texts here on the Country Hour this afternoon on the ABC right across WA. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.